Fine, whatever. 10 seconds.
Save.
See what happens.
Your tears see for another happens. Day.
Oh, what even is that?
The Weeknd.
He says not for the first time.
I'm Molly Wood, everyone. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where we make today make sense. The music of the day for Kai, if need be. Thanks for joining us. He's learning about The Weeknd. Super Bowl performer,
oh,
The Weeknd.
God. Oh, he was terrible. I hated him. It was terrible. That whole segment was terrible.
No.
Yes, it was terrible. Even, not just me being cranky old man, even my kids were like, Dad, this is dumb. This is terrible. And I'm like, I know.
I mean, he is very good. That might
not that segment.
Landed
not
for
that,
everyone.
Not that show.
That
yeah,
Super Bowl
no,
show.
All right. Phew. I'm Kai Ryssdal, in case it had somehow escaped your memory, or I don't even know. It's What Do You Want to Know Wednesday, or Cranky Old Man Rants at Things on this podcast today. We answer some of your questions, and we'll just get to it, so I don't get myself in any more trouble.
I think we shall. I feel emails bouncing off of your skin already. So yeah, let's go straight to our first question, a voicemail.
Hi, Kai and Molly. This is Megan in Kalamazoo, Michigan. My question is, I know that Jay Powell was, or at least I remember, I think I remember that he was put in place, so to speak, during the Trump year. He seems awesome,
yeah.
And that doesn't seem like it makes sense in my brain. So can you make me smart about how and why Jay Powell is chair of the Fed? Thanks so much. Love the show. Bye.
Yeah, it's actually a really good story. So there's a business correspondent who did a Twitter thread for us about 3-4 years ago on how exactly Powell wound up in that job on the Fed. First of all, on the Federal Reserve Board, to which President Obama appointed him in 2012, and then how that then led to him getting the top job from Donald Trump in 2018. So we're going to put that on our show page. It's really totally, totally interesting. You know, Powell is Powell. I mean, he's a Republican. He's a former investment banker. He's been in office since February of 2018. The big question now is, what is Biden going to do under pressure from progressives on the left who want the Fed to do more on banking regulation and climate change? Is he going to stay the course and follow what had been until Donald Trump the norm, which is that Fed chairs get reappointed at least once, no matter what party they are from? Trump, of course, thought Janet Yellen was, well, too short. And not bankerly enough looking. Yeah, mm-hmm. Too short.
Well, and his advisors. So he did think she was too short, and his advisors thought he should have, I believe, you know, his own guy, so to speak, even though Powell had been on the Federal Reserve Board for a long time.
Right, right.
But yeah, what is the deal? He was the last man standing?
Yeah, it's actually a really good Twitter thread. And Tony or Grace or whoever's in charge of that now is going to put it on the show page because it's really, really interesting. And I will tweet it out later, actually, too, because it's it's just totally fascinating. One of the interesting things about Jay Powell now and his reappointment, if it happens or not, is that there has been only one Democrat appointed to chair the Fed since, like, Jimmy Carter. Which is kind of amazing. It was, of course, Janet Yellen, but everybody else has been a Republican, right? Alan Greenspan was there for like 18 years, and then it was Bernanke for 8, and then it was Powell for 4, and now it's been, Yellen for 4, and now it's Powell. So, you know, the Dems have a legitimate, you know, hey, man, how about we have a Democrat on there with some progressive ideas, right? It's fair. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah. We don't know. But yes, to your sort of central question, which is like, how did he turn out to not be a disaster? You know, one assumes he learned some stuff while he was on the Federal Reserve and wasn't. I mean, I think that is what is assumed in the question is like, wait a second. So many other people turn out to not be the best people. So I think we can sort of say Jerome Powell was handed an unusual set of circumstances and definitely we'll be debating the moral hazard for a long time of like all this cheap money flowing into businesses and being used to buy back stocks and all of those things, but has gotten, you know, pretty high marks overall for at least dealing with these crises.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah. So there you go.
Sweet.
Next. Corey in North Carolina has this question. It's an email. I always hear about USA borrowing a lot of money, though cheaply. Who are we borrowing from? Looking forward to getting my banana pants, which we should point out is something like one of like 1,200 pair of banana pants that all y'all said you wanted in the course of
small batch sensation.
For small batch sensation. Mollywood. Wow. Yeah. Okay. So super, 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 super quick. So first of all, we did an episode on the federal debt and deficit, and you should go listen to that. And we'll also get that on the show page. But we're borrowing from anybody who's going to buy our bonds, man. When the United States government wants to borrow money, we sell these things called treasury notes, bills, and bonds. The name varies based on how long the maturation period is for that particular instrument. It goes from, overnight-ish, really, kind of, but 30 days out to 30 years. And we sell them, and we say to you, lender, whoever it's going to be, right, because you're lending us money. When you buy government debt, you are lending us $100, if you buy a $100 treasury bond. You're lending that money to us for, 10, 20, 30 years, right? We say to you, we will give you at maturation your principal back plus X amount of interest, whatever the market bears. And the people and organizations and companies buying our debt are everybody. Retirement funds, companies, other countries, Japan principally, and China, also the UK. Companies buy it. We buy it. I mean, everybody buys it, right? America, this is the reason the debt crisis, the debt limit thing is so important. Everybody buys American debt because it is the safest investment on the planet. We do not default on our debt, right? We always pay it until Republicans in Congress decide to start playing politics, which is what's going on now. And that's
going on.
Yeah. And always, I mean, every time there's a debt limit crisis, it's the Republicans, literally every time. Yeah. Every time.
I read, hold on, I'm trying to find it because I took a screenshot of it today. I read the Heather Cox Richardson newsletter.
Yeah.
Letters from an American, which is remarkable. It's, historical in nature. And today it talked about the debt ceiling and how back in the day, Republican leader and Union veteran James Garfield had fought the Confederates on the battlefields and recognized that destroying the government by starving it, I'm now reading from my screenshot, was no different from destroying it through arms. He urged President Rutherford B. Hayes to veto the Democrats' appropriation bills because back then it was Democrats. The parties have since flipped. Back then it was Democrats who were opposing raising the debt limits and had put through these appropriation bills that would have shut it down and not raise the debt limit. Hayes did veto those bills 5 times. Democrats backed down, but not before voters turned against them. The next year, voters put Garfield into the White House. I just thought that was a remarkable line. Destroying the government by starving it was no different from destroying it through arms.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And look, just one last globalization thing, right?
Yeah.
So that was 150 years ago. Imagine the global economy now, today, how much more intertwined it is. And if America goes, we're not paying, right? Imagine what happens. It all goes haywire.
I mean, because I was about to make the comparison to the Evergrande company just this week. So you saw, a really big real estate company in China with $300 billion of debt all of a sudden is in danger of not being able to pay that debt. And it causes the biggest drop in the stock market since last May. So multiply that times, I don't know, infinity.
Right.
And understand that this is like not a joke. Not a joke.
Yeah.
Next up, we have a question that I think a lot of you and us and almost everybody I know has been wondering.
Hi, this is Rebecca in Salt Lake City. I was chatting with a friend last weekend who sadly lost his job last year, and we were talking about all the talk that's out there about finding new work because there's so many jobs available. But he said he sent at least up to 100 resumes everywhere and wasn't hearing anything back from anyone. Now, although he did finally find a job, it certainly wasn't anywhere in his field. And I was just wondering if there is a big mismatch happening. Thanks, as always, for making me smart.
Yeah, this is happening. The short version of this is definitely happening. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has done a bunch of reporting on this, and it is more than one mismatch, right? One of the mismatches, of course, is that it is hard to find a high-paying job. There are lots and lots and lots of jobs available in restaurants right now and in the service industry. And so if you're out there and you're like, yeah, but I'm a person who works in an office and types things, I don't know, I'm just now making caricatures of office workers, but you know what I mean? That there might be
I literally work in an office and type things. That's what I do.
Type things, and then occasionally we say things. So,
that's right.
You know, yeah.
That's right.
And there are like several things going on. One is this skills mismatch, or what is a perceived skills mismatch, right? Like companies haven't figured out yet that maybe the bachelor's degree that they're requiring is not the same as the skills that they need, or the 5 years experience in this one job isn't actually the same as the skills that you would get from five years experience in something else. So you have this like dual thing where there could just be too many jobs in one sector. There is also this sort of like rigid requirement situation that is not always a skills match. There's geography. There's, you know, jobs might be where workers have left. Maybe they bailed during the pandemic and moved somewhere else. And so now, you know, jobs are available where they used to be. And then there are these expectations. There are workers saying, I want flexibility. I want higher pay to match, you know, maybe what I was getting on expanded unemployment or even regular unemployment because wages are still so low. And so you have this situation where as of the end of July, there were about 11 million job openings, 750,000 more job openings than there were at the end of June. But the number of workers hired into jobs basically stayed the same.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing to know is that this dislocation in the labor market is going to go on for a while. Right. That's going to be one of the lasting, to quote Jay Powell here, scars on this economy for sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely not.
Absolutely.
Okay. Colin in Canada, here's what he says. Do you think climate change is a problem that can only be solved by geoengineering?
Wow. No. Geoengineering, we should say, is this like blanket term. See, okay, this is where I'm just going to embarrass myself because I love terrible movies. There's this movie called Geostorm with Gerard Butler where they like engineered this whole system of satellites to manipulate the weather from space. And then, of course, somebody like sabotages it and it's going to like kill everybody on Earth with our own geoengineering technology. But I digress. It is this blanket term to refer to technologies that try to tackle weather or the impacts of the climate crisis directly. So the one that seems to have the most promise that people are really into is this idea of carbon capture, carbon removal, the idea of literally taking all of this excess carbon dioxide out of the air so that the atmosphere traps less heat. There are various there are attempts to do that like large scale straight out of the atmosphere. And then there are these smaller kind of carbon capture ideas, which is like if you have carbon emitting plants and factories and, you know, agriculture operations, that you would be able to capture the carbon before it ever makes it to the atmosphere and like sequester it underground. Then there are wilder ideas like Geostorm and the network of satellites or solar engineering or cloud seeding to make it rain. Yep. Many of those things are still at the concept stage, although I think in Dubai they're actually doing cloud seeding to try to generate rain.
Like for climate stuff? Wow. Yep. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, yeah. So that's like the big thing about geoengineering is that some of it is potentially extremely dangerous. Like we don't know. We still don't know enough about global weather. Like, but we certainly know that if you mess with it in one place, it's going to cause an equal and opposite effect in another place.
Right.
Yeah.
Also, humankind is an idiot. That's the Jesus.
Yeah. So like alone. Yeah. No way is it the only solution. And it is, but it is often held up as this kind of fantasy of like, oh, well, if we can just like re-engineer the weather, then we don't have to change anything about how we live. Yeah. And that is never going to happen. That's just not, I'm sorry. We have to change how we live. Like that's just not an option. And the climate has already changed. So even if there were some carbon capture that was to start now, we'd still have to like lower emissions and, yeah, it's a whole.
Now,
we
should explain. Yeah, we should explain why you're so up to speed on all this stuff.
That I'm super up to speed and super obsessed with all of this because, indeed, as you may have guessed from our many hints, my super secret project that I've been working on for the last 5 months or 4 or 5 months or so is in fact related to the climate crisis. For 2.5 years or so on the tech show, we've been doing this series called How We Survive, which is about adaptation and climate solutions. And now it's a podcast, and we're going to play you a little part of the trailer because it launched today.
Because it's cool.
Experts say we have 10 years to get on the right track to prevent the most catastrophic outcomes of the climate crisis. That's 10 years best case. We need to stop burning fossil fuels immediately and transition to clean energy. That transition hinges on lithium. And right now, the world doesn't have nearly enough.
So I think this is the lithium that they're going for.
Oh, really?
Yes, this is what they're mining. This is the white gold.
Billions of dollars are suddenly flooding into lithium mining and extraction, a new gold rush. But unlike the gold rush of the 1800s, this time our survival could be at stake. So join me as I follow the money and the human stories behind the race to mine lithium in the U.S. And trust me, some of this trip will even be fun.
Oh, God.
In case, dear listener, you're wondering what that was, it was a freaking sand tornado. It's like a cartoon out here, but like the really fatal kind. This is like a zombie apocalypse scene. Like we're walking down an empty highway. There's like bubbling freaking hot ass water right here.
There we go.
Oh my God. I was just waiting for the swear. How We Survive season one.
I was.
Out October 6th. Yep.
I was. I was going to say the one you played for us in the All Staff yesterday had swearing and I was waiting for the swearing.
He's like, when's the swearing going to happen? Because it's a podcast. I promise I will stop after this. The How We Survive feed, the podcast feed, is live now on all the podcatchers. So it would be amazing if while you're subscribing to Make Me Smart, because you haven't already and I don't know why, you also subscribe to that. And then when the new episode comes, you'll be ready and we will like rock up the charts. Burpee-oo!
There you go. Subscribe
and
now.
Also, of course,
follow.
Thank you for all your support. Videos. That's why we get to do projects like this, because of you,
yeah.
Dear listener, totally you and your true. Banana pants. You make it happen.
All 1,200 pair of them. We're gonna have to do some kind of group shot. All right, we're done for today. Back tomorrow on a Thursday. Send us your questions, comments, whatever. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Voicemail works too. 508-827-6278. 508 UB smart. And we are out of here. If Charlton's paying attention.
Yeah, yes, you do.
All right.
UB.
All right.
Make Me Smart is produced and researched by the wonderful Marissa Cabrera. Today's program was engineered by Charlton Thorpe, our intern and also an excellent researcher, Grace Rubin.
Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. Our senior producer is Bridget Bodner. She's in charge of everything. Pretty much, actually.
Pretty much. I wouldn't mess with her.
A lesson hard learned by the guy on this end of the microphone. Just saying. Just say. Oh my goodness. There we go.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.